Citizen Sounds, a diverse collection of sounds and stories from our researchers, educators, and students, sharing knowledge and insight to make a difference in Leicester and the world. We are Citizens of Change, University of Leicester. I'm Tree King, Professor of Public Engagement at the University of Leicester, and today I'm talking to Sue Page, who is Professor of Physical Geography. We'll be chatting about her research on peatland use and management, but first, Sue, tell me, how did you come to be at the University of Leicester? You trained as an ecologist first, so how did you become a professor in geography?
Well, actually, geography departments all over the UK and probably elsewhere in the world as well are very broad in their interests. And that's inevitable because you've got a subject which deals with both the physical aspects of the environment and the human aspects of the environment. So actually, ecology fits in perfectly well. You know, I work with colleagues who've trained originally as mathematicians, as chemists, as art historians, and so on. So a few have also trained in geography, of course. But yeah, we bring together a very broad range of subject areas.
So I know your work focuses on peatlands. So let's start at the beginning. What is peat? What are peatlands? How do they form, and where do we find them?
Okay, well, peat's a soil type, I suppose, but it's a very unusual soil type in that it's made up mostly of organic material. So plant remains, effectively. And they form wherever you've got locations in the landscape that are wet. And it's that wetness that encourages plant material to accumulate. So it's a bit like a wet compost heap. If you've got plant material being added at the top from the vegetation and it's wet, then there's a very limited amount of decomposition that takes place. So over time, that plant material that's being added from the surface accumulates and can actually form, you know, really deep deposits of this peaty, wet organic material, meters and meters deep, even up to 20 meters deep in some locations.
Wow, I didn't know it could get that deep. That's pretty incredible. So where do you find peatlands? Are they in particular parts of the world or do you find them everywhere? Or,
well, given that they're usually found in places that are wet, it's not surprising that high rainfall locations are often where we find peatlands. Low temperature, high rainfall, the Scottish Highlands, the west coast of Scotland, the Pennines. Those are good locations to find peatlands on our own doorsteps. But actually, peatlands are found in many, many countries of the world. They're most abundant in the north, northern high latitudes, so large expanses of Canada, northern Europe into Russia. But of course, we also now know that we have very expansive peatlands in the tropics as well, where of course the temperatures aren't low. We have high temperatures, but we still have high rainfall. Peatlands tend to form in low depressions in the landscape where there's very poor drainage.
So I read somewhere that they cover about 3% of the global land surface. Is that right?
But they store somewhere around about 650 billion tonnes of carbon. And just to put that in some sort of perspective, that's more than all the carbon that's stored in the world's vegetation. So despite covering a really, really small proportion of the Earth's surface, the fact that they are such dense carbon stores and can be in some locations really deep means that they are really vast carbon stores. And of course, that's important for our climate, because we know that with climate changing, that that's being driven to a large extent by the buildup of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. So peatlands are fantastic systems. If they're left alone, they will draw down carbon from the atmosphere through all that growth of the vegetation. And a big proportion of that carbon then gets stored in the peat over really long time periods, so thousands and thousands of years.
And that's really important, isn't it? Because we've got the natural carbon cycle, and they're a part of this. So this is where carbon is naturally released by living things that are breathing. And the balance is maintained, isn't it, by plants and the ocean. They absorb it. So the problems come in that we're increasing our CO2 through things like burning fossil fuels, whilst we're also deforesting. So we're getting this buildup of CO2 in the atmosphere. It collects, it stores heat, it throws the cycle out of whack, and it leads to this global temperature increase. And this peat is acting as this carbon store, isn't it? So, and because they're wet, they're involved in water management, and aren't they kind of vital part of like the global food security? They're really valuable bits of our environment, aren't they?
They are. I suppose, given our concerns about climate changing at the moment, that the most important role is actually in carbon storage. And as long as they remain wet, they will continue to act in that way to draw down the carbon from the atmosphere. So they're a really important sink for atmospheric carbon. And of course, we are increasing the amount of carbon in our atmosphere, as you said, from fossil fuel burning and so on. So we really want our land carbon sinks and our ocean carbon sink to keep operating effectively and efficiently. But yes, some peatlands have been managed for other purposes, not just as carbon sinks. So in some parts of the world, they're really important for agriculture and for food security and for livelihood security. And that's true of eastern England, the fens, which have been drained now for getting on for 300 years, started by the Dutch. And they drained this land because it had a potential for high agricultural productivity. But we now know that those peatlands, despite the fact that they provide important food sources for the UK, are now a very strong source of greenhouse gas emissions, carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. So this isn't a problem that's confined to the UK. We've also got peatlands in Europe that are used for agriculture, and we've got peatlands in other parts of the world, particularly in Southeast Asia. And the problem is that for agriculture, most of the crops that are grown on peatlands are what we might call dryland crops. So they need a dry soil for their growth to be successful. So we have to drain the peatlands. And as soon as we drain them, we're taking away that waterlogging, the constraint on the breakdown of the organic material. And so we lower the water levels, put in drainage ditches. And as soon as we do that, we start microbial decomposition of the peat so that the carbon that might have been stored there for hundreds or thousands of years starts to be released quite rapidly back to the atmosphere. So we're changing our peatlands from a carbon sink to a carbon source.
That's incredibly important, because the more we disturb our peatlands, we're actually converting what could be a really efficient way of mitigating climate change into something that's actually driving climate change, aren't we?
Yes, and this is a particular issue where we have these expansive areas of drained peatland. So lowland Britain, I've mentioned the fens, which are important for agriculture and for food security in Britain. So a lot of our salad products at the moment in the supermarkets are coming from that part of the world. So lettuce, radish and so on. There's also been a lot of drainage in the peatlands in the UK uplands, in the Pennines, for example, where drains have been put in the past to try to improve the productivity of the land for sheep grazing, for example. There's also been extensive drainage in other parts of the world to support forestry on peatland. And as I mentioned, in Southeast Asia, again, we see really expansive areas there of drained peatland, drained to support smallholder farmers for a range of crops, but also very large-scale plantations as well, which are either producing palm oil or are producing pulp for paper production.
What else do people use it for? So you've mentioned about agriculture. I know, I mean, it's quite famously used in Ireland as a kind of like, almost like firewood, isn't it? It's like a heat source. What else is it used for by people at the moment?
The main uses are for agricultural or forestry land uses. Yes, some peat is burnt. In fact, for a long time, peat was extracted from some of the vast bogs in the centre of Ireland and used for power production, so for electricity production. That's now ceased, but there are still other countries in Europe that have peat-powered electricity generating stations. So that's one issue. And peat is also used in horticultural growing media as well. So a lot of composts that we buy in garden centres have some mix of peat in them. And it's not just for hobby gardeners. It's also important for the horticultural trade as well. So for growing vegetables, for example, or for growing pot plants, for example. So all of those trades and industries are using peat in one form or another. But of course, it's a destructive use because peat's a finite resource. It takes thousands of years for peat to accumulate, and we're using it quite rapidly. And of course, all of those uses are converting that stored carbon to CO2, carbon dioxide, which has been released into the atmosphere and which is a powerful greenhouse gas.
I know you started looking at peatlands in Borneo back in the 1990s. So what were you working on there?
Okay, so this was quite a long time ago now, about 25 years ago. And our initial research out there was really focused on the natural systems, which are wonderful. They're a forested peatlands. They have a huge rainforest on top of this really deep peat layer, which may be, you know, it's up to 15 metres deep. So incredibly diverse systems, fascinating systems, which at that time very few people had studied. And so our interest was really in the nature of the systems and also the biodiversity that they supported as well. But by the middle of the 1990s, Indonesia had come up with a plan for a large-scale agricultural project in Indonesian Borneo. And this involved putting in drainage. They deforested the land, they drained the peatland. And in 1997, there was a very intense drought. And because fire is used as a typical land management tool in that part of the world, fire started and fire spread. And peat burns. And it was the fact that in 1997 to 98, we had very, very extensive fires burning, not just on the island of Borneo, but also in Sumatra. Many of those were associated with drained peatlands. And so my research really then shifted from studying the natural system, which I still continue to do, but moved really to also consider what the impacts of land use change were on our peatland systems and how that influenced the carbon cycle. And really, that's the direction that my research has taken ever since.
So this management of peatlands is clearly really critical then. So can we develop or restore peatlands in any ways, or how do we do that, and what are the challenges, what are the benefits? And presumably your work is going to involve working with local communities. It's kind of quite a really interesting interdisciplinary area that you work in.
Yes, absolutely. So really, it's I'm in a geography department and I'm in the right place to be, because my research has indeed involved now having to think about livelihoods and, you know, economic returns from the land and so on, all of which, of course, is encompassed within geography. So in terms of how we manage our peatlands, I think there are really three or four strategies. The first one is to protect any systems that are undamaged. They're absolutely vital because they still function as a carbon sink. They're still bringing carbon down from the atmosphere. So we must do everything we can to protect those systems. In addition, of course, they're home to some marvellous wildlife, whether it's orangutans in Borneo or unusual insectivorous plants in other parts of the world. So the second option really, or the challenge, is to restore degraded peatlands. So restoration is really all about keeping the peat wet or getting the peat back to a wet condition. So it's about blocking up drainage ditches, for example, and trying to restore the natural water levels. And behind that will come restoration of the vegetation, either naturally or we have to encourage it, for example, by planting appropriate plant species. The hardest challenge, if you like, is how we manage our agricultural peatlands. And that's really still the forefront of research at the present time. So we know that if we raise water levels nearer to the surface, we can reduce the carbon emissions. The challenge is, if we raise the water levels, can we still use them for these dry land crops to grow lettuce, for example, in eastern England, or to grow other crops like maize in Indonesia, for example? There probably are opportunities to raise water levels, maybe not all year round, maybe for part of the year, and that would really make a big contribution. So myself and others are involved in research programs at the present time that are looking at those opportunities. The other option is to just raise the water level really close to the surface and move away from dry land crops to new crops. And this is very innovative area. It's something that's sometimes called swamp cultivation, or it has a rather more posh name, which is polluticulture. And this means we're trying to find ways in which we can really cut back on the carbon emissions, but also get some economic benefit from the land. So this has been trialled quite extensively in Germany, where they grow, for example, reed grass, and that can be then harvested and used for a whole range of products. Maybe it's briquettes for fuel, or it's being incorporated into fiberboard for construction purposes and so on. So those sorts of experiments are just starting in the Fens of England. So that's all very exciting. Whether there will be food crops that we can grow on wet peatlands is still to be investigated, really. It's not just a question of finding the right crops or native species that could perhaps be bred as crops, but it's also finding the right markets for those products as well. So this is also work that's happening in Indonesia, other parts of the world as well. Can we encourage ways in which we can manage those drain peatlands to get the water levels up and find appropriate crops? And of course, in Southeast Asia, if we can make the peatlands wetter, we'll also reduce the fire risk as well. And that's also really important.
It's a really fine balancing act from what you're saying. So you've got large numbers of people who rely on these peatlands for their livelihoods. So you can't realistically expect all of them to be kind of fully returned, but having them helps cut the CO2 in the atmosphere, which we desperately need. So it sounds like you're in all sorts of areas. Like, you know, it's all about land management, but it's economy and agriculture. It sounds like a really interesting area to work in.
It is, absolutely. So the projects I'm working in now are nearly all interdisciplinary. So, you know, my team that we have, in the department, there's another professor who works with me. She's a social scientist, and we have two postdocs at the moment, one of whom is truly interdisciplinary. She did her PhD with us and mixed physical science, natural science with social science. And the other postdoc is an agricultural social scientist. So yeah, it has broadened my expertise considerably. But there's no way that we can be involved in these sorts of conversations with farming communities if we're just going to focus on the natural sciences. We've got to take into account the livelihood issues, you know, economic issues as well. That's absolutely vital.
You've just touched on this right now. So it needs to go higher, doesn't it? It's converting this knowledge that you've got into policy and practice. So it needs to become part of government policy, doesn't it? I know this is something that you're really working on at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. So the sorts of projects that we're involved with in the UK now are feeding into discussions that are being hosted by DEFRA, our Department of Environment, and they are seeking to find ways in which we can more responsibly manage our lowland peatlands in the UK. So these are conversations that are focused very much on those agricultural peatlands. So yes, our research is feeding into those kind of conversations. And it's also feeding into similar conversations in other parts of the world as well. So to do with, for example, the way in which oil palm plantations on peatland are managed, given that the product, palm oil, ends up in a vast range of food and cosmetic products, but also ends up in so-called green biofuels. And of course, if you're using palm oil, which is produced on a drained peatland, where the peatland itself is emitting vast amounts of greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere, then that so-called green biofuel may actually have quite a high carbon footprint associated with it. So getting that message through to policymakers has also been quite important. And that information has been picked up and has been used in policies in Europe and a few other countries as well.
It must feel really good to be a part of this. I mean, because I find climate change, sometimes it feels so overwhelming. It's like, what can we do? But here you are at the forefront of chipping away at that, at turning the tide a little bit on this.
Yeah, I think so. And I agree, climate change is a huge issue and we all feel responsible, but it's hard to know what we can do. And I think this is one way in which research can have a real world benefit. And that's what I enjoy, actually. I really enjoy doing research where I can see that it will have some ultimate use. It may be tricky along the way because conversations with farming communities who have managed the land in a certain way for a very long period of time, they're never going to be easy. Nobody adapts to change easily. And the same is true with plantation industry as well. So these are often challenging conversations. They're not always conversations that go in the direction that you would like, but I think it's having the conversation that matters.
What's been the impact of your work so far? What does your research mean to the person on the street?
That's a good question. And I think all scientists, perhaps all academics, should ask that question, actually. I mean, it has had an impact. It's maybe not a very visible impact because, you know, when you're influencing, for example, European Union policy on biofuels, I think most people wouldn't be really aware of that. I think some of the other research, you know, has led to, you know, a bit more impact. The fact that, you know, we've now got research teams working on orangutan populations in Borneo that when we went out there in 1993, we didn't even know they were in the forest. And then we found out they were, and big population and Bornean gibbon and so on. So all of that side of things has been really, you know, exciting, not for me to take forward. I'm not a wildlife ecologist, or a behavioral ecologist, but other people have taken that forward. So that's been really exciting. My former PhD student, Sarah, who's now working with me as postdoc, she did a lot of work on fish communities in the peatlands, very understudied area, and that has revealed a lot of really interesting and new research. You know, aquaculture, growing fish, could be one livelihood support for people in these peatlands if they have to move away from dryland agriculture. So that could be exciting, but it's still in at the development phase, really. And I suppose finding, you know, through the team that I've worked with at the University of Leeds, exploring and finding this vast area of peatland in the Congo, that has been a really, really exciting part of the research that I've been involved in. So, yeah, I get all my thrills from the PhD students. That's where the excitement is, I think.
But that is what science is about. It's that those little incremental steps, and the fact that it sometimes will go off in directions that you never thought of
You
started this.
Absolutely.
This thing. Yeah.
I mean, the fires, for example, you know, I mean, when we started work in the early 1990s, we had no idea that within a few years we were going to be engulfed by flames and smoke from peatland fires, and that our research, you know, would take a very different turn at that point. So the, you know, a big project that I'm involved at that moment, which is based in Indonesian Borneo, is all about how to reduce fire risk in that part of the world.
So tell me about that, and then you need to tell me about the peatlands in the Congo.
So
tell me about this fire risk.
The new project, which is being, of course, hugely hampered by COVID restrictions and travel restrictions, which is a huge shame. But having worked out in that part of the world for many years, of course, we've got a great team of colleagues out in Indonesia. So we work closely with them, and they're really, you know, being champions of this project. So what we're really trying to understand is what the drivers are of fires in Indonesian Borneo, particularly the peat fires, and to understand how those fires are impacting on people's lives, their health and their livelihoods, and what we can do to really reduce fire risk. So what can we do to move people away from using fire as part of their day-to-day land management? And what can we do to improve their standard of living, really, in terms of exposure to pollutants from fires and so on?
And this peatland in the Congo that you just touched on. So what's this, a new discovery of a peatland in the Congo?
Yeah, so this was about 4 years ago now when we published a new map of the peatland in the Congo. And this was all led by a PhD student who was at the University of Leeds called Greta. And she was intrepid and spent a lot of months in the field mapping the location of the peatlands, taking peat cores so that she knew the depth of the peatland, and using a lot of remote sensing satellite imagery to come up with the first definitive map of the location of the peatland. And whilst it was known that there was some peat probably somewhere in the Congo, until she did her study, the extent of it really wasn't known. So really important finding. And that, of course, has led on to subsequent projects, which Greta is still involved with, I'm glad to say, and led by Simon Lewis at the University of Leeds. And that has led us in all sorts of different directions, looking at why the peat formed, where it did, how long it's been there, what are the climatic controls on peat formation, and what might the future bring in terms of climate change for these peatlands.
So what's next for you? I know COVID has really, it's affected research, hasn't it? But what's next?
Gosh, I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm sure the research in Kalimantan will carry on, and probably the research in the Congo will carry on as well, and in the UK. And I think in the UK, the challenge is, you know, can we develop even at a trial scale operational farming systems where we reduce the carbon emissions by raising water levels, but still have some sort of agricultural activity happening on the soil? And if we can get it to work in the UK, then we will work with farmers in a similar way, I'm sure, in Indonesia, and try to see if we can get similar systems established there. So I think that's the challenge in the next couple of years.
It's really exciting stuff. So it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks, Thierry.
Citizen Sounds, University of Leicester. Visit le.ac.uk.